Welcome to ScotsCast, the Bible teaching podcast of Scots Church Melbourne.
My thought starting question this morning is this: what do you really value deep down? What is it that you really aspire to, or if you've got it already, that you really hold on to as dearly as life itself? Research says, and this is from last year's Australian National Values Survey, research says that traditional Aussie values like mateship have been replaced in younger generations by things like sustainability and progressiveness. Significantly in the survey, it turns out that achievement these days rates very high after years and years of the famous Australian tall poppy syndrome that played achievement down. New generations apparently love success, just as long as it's sustainable as well. But again, that's a question. In your mind, what does success look like? Which brings me back to where we finished last week, if you were with us, and that post I mentioned from Twitter, all about the things we should aspire to. It was, if you remember, a post from a Twitter account called The Hellenist, a guy who genuinely admires the Greek gods who he says are far superior to Jesus. Because real gods like Zeus, he says, are forms of the good. Zeus represents strength and power and beauty and health and virtue, which are things not just we Australians, but I think we humans by nature aspire to. Let's call that option A, let's call that success. Whereas fake gods, says the Hellenist, fake gods like Jesus, are forms of the bad, things like weakness, powerlessness, humiliation, ugliness, emaciation. Let's call those things option B. And here in Luke's Gospel this morning, as we trace our way towards Easter, we have arrived at a key turning point, a fork in the road, a point at which real aspirations, real values are going to be laid bare for this inner circle of disciples of Jesus. Because maybe to this point, as they've watched Jesus healing people, maybe as they've watched Jesus calm a storm, they see him feed 5,000 people from almost nothing. As they've stood in awe and he reached out his hand and raised up the daughter of Jairus, maybe they're thinking that following Jesus is all about option A, and somehow just quietly ignored his words of warning. For example, back in Luke chapter 9, just after Peter articulates that Jesus is the Christ of God, Jesus says this. He says, "You're right, but don't go thinking the fact that I'm the one the Old Testament calls the Son of Man means you're going to be on easy street." He says this: "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. So if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life would lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will save it." Which sounds very much like option B. Humiliation, failure. So, straight after that, Peter and James and John see Jesus transfigured, glowing on a mountaintop. And then, astonishingly, healing a boy with an unclean spirit. Again, looks like option A. But then followed immediately by this. But while they were all marvelling at everything he was doing, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men." But they didn't understand this saying, and it was concealed from them, so they may not perceive it. He says the same again in chapter 14, "Count the cost." It's all about option B. And again in chapter 18, "We're going to Jerusalem," he says, "I'll be delivered over to the Gentiles, I'll be mocked, shamefully treated, and spat on. And then they'll kill me. And on the third day I'll rise." But again, verse 34, "They understood none of these things." It's hidden from them. Because how could one, with all the power they have seen in Jesus, possibly submit to weakness and powerlessness and humiliation? It just doesn't make sense. They're not the things the apostles, the disciples, aspire to at all. And most especially not Judas, who comes into the spotlight in chapter 22. It's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the start of Passover, and the chief priests and the scribes are trying to figure out how to put Jesus to death without causing a popular uprising. If you wonder what motivates Judas, you can see it straight away in verse 3 of our first reading. Luke wants us to know that behind everything else, things are unfolding on a spiritual plane. This is pure evil at work from the prince of darkness himself. He says, "Then Satan entered into Judas called Iscariot, who was of the number of the 12. A member of the inner circle has been turned by the evil one." And in the very next verse, he's in a secret meeting with the religious power brokers to work out how he can betray Jesus without causing a storm among the people. Something covert, in the cover of darkness, perhaps. Luke says, "And they were glad and agreed to give him money, so he consented and sought an opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of a crowd." Judas, for one, under the power of the evil one, isn't aspiring to option B. Judas doesn't see any value in service and self-sacrifice. Takes a pile of silver coins instead, worth incidentally about $600 in today's terms, or back then the price of a slave. Very cheap, when you think about it, for the Son of God. But you'll notice among the 12, he is not the only one Satan wants his way with. Let's take a look at Peter just a little later. They share one last supper together, the Passover, and after they've eaten, Jesus turns to Peter with a knowing prediction. It's worth a careful look because it's significant that again, Luke shows Satan at work behind the scenes. Jesus sees it very clearly. Satan wanting a hold not just on Judas, not just Peter, but all of them, which is disguised a little bit in our English translations by the fact that we don't have a different word for the singular and the plural you, except if you grew up in country New South Wales, where you said you's lot quite often. Greek was very specific with singular and plural forms of you, and the first two in the verse we're about to see are plural. Verse 31, as Jesus draws Peter aside, here's what he's saying. "Simon, Simon," Peter's formal Jewish name. Behold, Satan demanded to have you all, you plural. He wants to sift you all like wheat. Like that opening scene, do you know it, in the Old Testament book of Job? The heavenly courtroom where Satan says to God, let me test him. Now it's let me test all of them. I've got Judas already. Let me work over the other 11, see what they really value. Now, before you go all skeptical on me or you go overboard and make this like an exorcist movie, will you notice very simply what it is that Satan wants to achieve in his sifting? And that is very simply, he wants them to give up their allegiance to Jesus, to value other things more. Easy with Judas, it only took 30 pieces of silver. What's it going to take with the other guys? More to the point, what would it take with you? A bit of a headwind, perhaps? A bit of hardship or loss? Someone lets you down? Or the offer of comfort and success? There is nothing more that Satan wants in verse 32, than for our faith in Jesus to fail. But here's a word of reassurance for Peter. And here the you switches to singular. Satan wants to sift you, but I've prayed specifically for you, Peter, that your faith won't fail. And when you've turned again, when you've come to your senses, then I want you to look out for the other guys. If the prayer of Jesus is answered, which ultimately, of course, it was, Peter's faith is not going to fail, but it sure is going to bend a bit. Even though, as you'll see, he's full of confidence. Lord, I'm ready for anything. I'm tough. I'm loyal. Look at his words. Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. And Jesus says, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny three times that you even know me. Well, let's see who's right. Now, at this point, we've set the scene. Satan turning Judas to betray Jesus somewhere out of the public eye. Satan keen to sift the other 11. Dinner's over. They go out into the darkness of night and head for the Mount of Olives, a private place where Jesus is going to pray a while. Judas heads off in the other direction because he senses now is the perfect time. After Jesus has prayed earnestly and the others have gone to sleep, just as Jesus is waking them, Judas arrives with a crowd that he's gathered from the temple, steps up to famously betray Jesus with a kiss. The 11 who can see what's unfolding pull out their swords. One of them strikes out and slices off the ear of the high priest's servant. Now, can you see? This is full on option A. One last ditch effort. Go out fighting. Strength and power can save the day. They're still not listening. Jesus says, no more. He reaches out and with a touch heals the man who's come to arrest him. Heals the man who is about to lead him back to the city in handcuffs, hand him over to his death. Now, friends, if you still haven't caught on to what Jesus is all about, there it is in microcosm. Jesus is going to go quietly. No need for swords and clubs. It's time. This is your hour, he says. The power of darkness. And so they seize him and they lead him away. Which is where we come to part two of the story of Peter, where his bold words are put to the test. I asked about values at the start, what it is that we hold on to, what we really count as important. You know, there's one thing that wasn't even in that survey, wasn't included in the list of things that Australians value, because I think it's one of those things that's just so ingrained, we don't even notice it. I think for the vast majority of us, one of the things that we most value is that we fit in with the crowd, that we largely go through life unnoticed, that we don't stand out or make a fuss or seem to be unusual. I was talking to a friend the other day about the trouble his 12-year-old daughter is having with her peer group at school. But let me tell you, it doesn't stop when you're a teenager. No matter what age you are, peer pressure rules. It rules over us with an iron rod. It creates a visceral fear in the pit of your stomach. And that, I think, is what counts now with Peter of the brave-sounding words, as he's challenged in the courtyard by a servant girl. There's a fire in the middle of the courtyard, and it's a story that's told in the pronouns as well as by the sense of distance. Notice carefully in the next couple of sentences where Peter is in relation to Jesus. Given that Peter is the guy who says, Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death. Just watch it unfold. There is they, the crowd who came to the garden. There's him, Jesus, and there's Peter. Watch where they go, verse 54. Then they seized him and led him away, bringing him to the high priest's house. And Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them. Now look, you don't need a degree in narrative analysis to spot it, do you? If there's Jesus over here and them who arrested him over there, where's Peter? He's not with Jesus, that's for sure. He follows at a distance and then he's sitting down among them, keeping warm with them, fully identified with the enemy, cozy in their fireside circle. Till, of course, he's challenged by that servant girl. You were with them. As quick as a flash, he denies it. Woman, I don't know him. Another voice. You're one of them. Man, I'm not. And a third, about an hour later, insisting he was for sure. You can tell by his Galilean accent. Man, I don't know what you're talking about. Three times denied, exactly as Jesus said he would. And then the rooster crows as Jesus looks at him across the courtyard from the distance. And Peter, realizing what he's done, goes out into the early morning cold and weeps bitterly, full of remorse for his own failure, having valued his own security and comfort over and above his loyalty to King Jesus in his hour of darkness. At this point, it's looking grim, isn't it? Judas betrays him, Peter denies him. The other 10, well, they're just gone. The power of darkness has prevailed. Or so it seems. And if you were aspiring to strength and power and beauty and health, seems you've come to the wrong place. Looks like in Jesus there is just weakness, powerless, humiliation, failure. Nobody wants to join him. But here's the thing, Peter's faith, his loyalty, ultimately, Jesus said this already, it's going to be badly bent. But I think even his tears of remorse show at this point it doesn't fail. Remember his words, and when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Which in due course we'll see he does. Things are going to get darker as we watch next week the trial, and then as we see the events of Good Friday unfold. But ultimately, it's the resurrection that turns things round and puts everything else in the right perspective, leaving us with the question in the end, what are we going to value? Because here is the reality, strength and power and beauty and health and success and prosperity and fitting in with the in-group, they all seem so much more appealing, don't they, than suffering and self-sacrifice and service, than humility, than self-denial, than faithful perseverance when things are tough. And often, like Peter, our loyalty to Jesus will wobble. The thing is, though, if you're only ever in it for the good times, if in your heart you are pursuing an option A life, if you're only chasing beauty and health and power, the reality of life in the real world is none of those things are going to last. Something, sometime, is always going to bring us crashing down to earth. And the real question is, is your faith built to survive that day? It's one thing for the Hellenist guy to post on Twitter, which gods we worship determine what we manifest. Be beautiful, be powerful, be strong. But real life's not like that, is it? And that is where real faith in the real Jesus is going to give real hope. A dear friend of ours in Queensland had some terribly disappointing health news this week. The first round of chemo didn't work. In a message to Lou on Tuesday, she said this. This is where the rubber hits the road with our faith. I'm so thankful that it's God who sustained us. Because we're both feeling pretty shaky right now. At some point for all of us, the rubber is going to hit the road for our faith. And the little voice of Satan will be saying, give it up. Why be loyal to Jesus? But friends, again, if there's one thing that the road to Easter Sunday is going to show, it's that when the rubber does hit the road, there is, in the end, a real hope and a vindication. A resurrection, which leaves us with the prospect that the humble road, the weak road, the road of long-term loyalty to King Jesus, is actually the road to real and lasting glory, even when we're feeling shaky right now.
You've been listening to Scotscast, the Bible teaching podcast of Scots Church Melbourne.